you go. Deck 78.
We just got out of the turbo lift, and boy, are we parched, because we're about to share with you a very interesting conversation, which at times felt like a therapy session, about the state of writing in Hollywood right now with a bunch of fantastic writers, fantastic writers. This is a spinoff of the popular Inside the Writers Room panel that Ashley, myself, and Steve, among others, do every year at Comic-Con. This year, we were lucky enough to sit down at WonderCon with Derek Hughes of Quantum Leap and Sarah Watson of Percy Jackson and Anselm Richardson of The Boys and Jeff Yorks of Muppets Mayhem, the Emmy Award-winning Muppets Mayhem, and also Mark Bernardin of such shows as Picard and Treadstone, and Amy Berg from Warrior Nun is currently on Law & Order Organized Crime. So it was a real slugger's row of talent. Unfortunately, Ashley and Steve couldn't be there, but they were with us in spirit and with spirits, which were imbibed quite extensively throughout the weekend. Replacing them was Darren Doctorman in the audience, who was there and provided some great moral support.
I lended moral support, yes. And I want it back one day.
Was it a shoulder to cry on?
Darren was just waiting for the good meals and the great Uber, which we talked about recently on Trekspers. We had a fantastic Uber driver who had a disco ball going in the Uber. He had a candy bar at our disposal and then proceeded to tell us about how James Cameron gave him a $700 tip, at which point he waxed nostalgically about how much he loved The Abyss. So we told him that Darren worked on The Abyss, and then he proceeded to tell us stories about the making of The Abyss, and then we proceeded to tell him once again that Darren worked on The Abyss.
And I was there. Yes, I know. He was there. I know these things you're telling me. Yes. It was great. It was the best Uber ride I've ever had.
It really was. We wish we could have given it more than 5 stars. I would have given it 10 stars. But he, I mean, if even James Cameron loved him, come on, yeah. James Cameron doesn't like anybody. It's like Mikey in Life Serial, but he loved this Uber driver. And
well,
I don't.
We didn't give him $700 though. Just
we
to
did
be
not. We gave him a very generous tip, we I did. Think. But it was not $700 worth of tip. That is for sure. But we had a lovely time at WonderCon. We're always appreciative of our friends at Comic-Con for having us. We're looking forward to great Comic-Con in July.
I'm not.
Well, Darren will be in Raleigh. At another wonderful GalaxyCon. But right now, we'd be delighted if you join us and you can learn more about the state of the industry. And if you're an aspiring writer, you may not want to listen because it's really depressing. Here we go as we go inside the writer's room right now. For all of you who braved the rain to come out here, thank you. I think this is the first Inside the Writer's Room we've done in 20 years now. And it doesn't have a pandemic. It doesn't have a strike. It doesn't have, we're back, and it's just like we're able to talk about everything and do all kinds of cool stuff. So thank you for coming to the WonderCon edition. Obviously, we've been doing this a lot at Comic-Con for many years, and we have many, many of our veterans returning for this panel. Lots to talk about because, of course, the industry, as we alluded to, is changing dramatically every day, and we'll talk about that. I'm Mark A. Altman. I've worked on the showrunner of Pandora, worked on Librarians. I have Deathlands coming out next year based on the books, and I'm author of The 50-Year Mission. So I'm so thrilled to introduce this amazing panel. We're going to have plenty of time for questions today. We got another supersized panel today, so that's great. And so make them count, think about them. And then, I'm delighted to welcome, he's a writer for such shows as Star Trek Picard, Master Universe Revelation, Treadstone, and Castle Rock, Mark Bernardin.
Pleasure.
playing first base for the New York. No, it's next. We are delighted. He has been doing these panels for a very long time. He's the host of SlamCon, but you may know him better as the co-executive producer of the new Quantum Leap. He's been worked on such shows as Arrow, The Flash, Warehouse 13, and got his start, and this is very important to acknowledge, as a writer's assistant on Andromeda. It's Derek Hughes. And I'm very delighted to have our returning champion back in the fold. It's been a couple of years now that we have been denied her insight and her presence on these panels, but she's back, and it is also Sarah Watson's birthday. I went to the Marriott to get a cake, but they wanted to charge me about $240, so we didn't get you a cake. And I tried to get you a little muffin. That was about $40. But we'll see what we can do later. She is a writer-producer, co-executive producer on Percy Jackson. Executive producer, excuse me. Titles matter, folks. She's executive producer on Percy Jackson. She was the creator of the Goonies recreation pilot. Did it ever have a title? Yeah, but it would have been glorious. And a writer-producer on Parenthood. She created The Bold Type for Freeform. And perhaps most impressively of all, with all those incredible credentials, and we have all of us have these in our closet, Disaster 2, Volcano in New York. Yeah. Our next panelist, he goes by Slim, but I'm going to introduce him by his proper credited name on television, but you can call him Slim. Anselm Richardson. He's a writer-producer on such shows as The Boys and Timeless. Of course, we met on Agent X, but nobody would remember that one. And the beginning was a very delicate time. Amy's been here since the beginning. She is a co-executive producer on Law & Order Organized Crime. Yep. Okay, I give you a demotion like I did for Sarah. She was the EP on Warrior Nun, created Counterpart, an EP. She also worked on Eureka and Leverage, and if I recited all her credits, we'd be here all day. So Amy Berg. Hey, now, this next guy is on double secret probation. We've never had him on one of our panels. We're trying him out here in the farm leagues to see if he rates being invited to San Diego. So we'll see. At the end of the panel, we can vote if we want to keep him. I'm talking about the Emmy Award winner for Muppets Mayhem. He is also responsible, and this is going to be really interesting. We've never had this perspective before, because he started as an editor, and his trailers helped sell The Goldbergs, Cobra Kai, Carnival Row, and Twisted Metal. So I have a lot of insights into what it takes to sell a show as well as make a show. And of course, I'm welcoming Jeff Yorks, ladies and gentlemen. And another triumphant return. He's been on an extended hiatus from this panel, but we are so happy to have him back. I was thrilled when he answered the bat signal to return. And I'm talking about, he's a writer for such shows as Blood and Treasure, Legacies, La Brea, Agent Carter, Grimm, and of course, hold your applause, please, Firefly. Jose Molina. Did I mention your name?
What's his name?
Who's this? That was a dramatic pause. Jose Molina.
No name necessary.
Yep.
And I am not Chris Parnell, but he will be back for San Diego, or so I'm told.
Yay.
So, thanks, Amy.
Thank God.
I know. I feel the same way. It's a lot less work for me when Chris is moderating these panels. So, you know, we alluded to this idea that television has changed dramatically for a variety of reasons. Is it for good or bad? What does the new normal look like? And I'm going to start. Sarah, you look like you really want to answer that. Tell us sort of, you know, the 30,000 feet view of the industry today.
I don't even know if I can describe it. Weird and different. It used to just be that we just had networks and things moved on a schedule, and now nobody knows what they want. Everything moves really slow, and I'm so grateful to be working.
Yeah.
I hope that was helpful.
Yeah. No. We'll drill down, but I kind of want to get a sense, because we've done these panels for a lot of years, and I think the industry has gone through one of the greatest changes that we've seen in all the years we've been doing this panel. Amy, would you agree with that?
I think that's true. I've been around long enough to see the industry go through major contractions followed by booms. And what we're in right now is a major contraction. And, there's not a lot of people buying stuff. There's not a lot of jobs to be had. But they will come back.
Yeah,
maybe not to the extent of the last streaming boom, but they will come back. There will always be jobs for the people who want it bad enough.
Mark, what do you attribute sort of this contraction to? Obviously, the rise of streaming, everyone pegged as this wonderful thing initially. It's like, Netflix isn't giving notes. We can do whatever we want. They're buying all these shows. They're paying all this money. It's a very different world that we're living in right now in terms of, you know, the what streamers are looking for, what a network order looks like when they exist. How do you look at the world we're living in as TV writers these days?
I feel like what had happened was Hollywood broke itself trying to chase fool's gold. And, you know, because Netflix started, it's like, oh, hey, Netflix and all these subscribers, and they're making all this money, although they weren't, but it seemed like they were. And everybody's like, we have to have a Netflix too. So let's all make a Netflix. And let's all kind of just try to subsist on $15.99 a month from as many people as we can, as opposed to ad sales and syndication fees and carriage rights and all the ways that people got rich in Hollywood for decades. They're like, we don't want that anymore. We want this thing that doesn't really work, and we're going to find the bottom of it in about 2 years. And that's where we are. And we're slowly, awkwardly, clumsily reinventing cable, which is the thing that made everybody rich and made everybody make lots of TV and gave everybody here their first breaks. Cable was great. Cable gave you content on a streaming basis. You didn't have to subscribe to anything but one thing. And so now we're at the bottom of a bit of a trough. And I think climbing out of it is going to take a while. We will, because, you know, as everybody knows, they have to make things. This is what we do. This is the product we sell. But remembering how to do that and how everybody can get paid in the process is going to take us a couple of years.
Yeah. Jeff, streaming seemed like the gold ring for a while, the brass ring. And here you won an Emmy. You had a show that was critically acclaimed. And after one season, they don't go forward. We've heard the story a lot. That must be... So again, sort of the musing on the nature of streaming, and I imagine from a personal point of view, that must be very, because in the old days, think about something like Hill Street Blues. No one watched Hill Street Blues, but it got great in the beginning, got amazing reviews, and NBC kept it on the air for years and years and years, and it grew an audience. That doesn't really seem to happen now.
No, it seems like you're given very little chance. It's all about numbers. There's so much television out there. You're competing with so many other shows. I suppose if they don't advertise your show, no one's going to know it exists. It just gets lost in that whole thing. I think that's certainly what happened to our show. People are discovering. You may have just discovered today there was a new Muppet show that came out. There's so much out there. And there was certainly a following. Muppet fans are very loyal. But our numbers were so low that I don't think that it was... They weren't waiting around to give it another chance. My partner, Adam, was the creator of The Goldbergs. And his plea was like, look, no one watched The Goldbergs season one. Please give us a chance. We have our audience. We know what we could do to change it, to improve it. Give us that chance. Disney Plus, on the other hand, is in a place right now where they're like, they're not necessarily looking for shows to greenlight. They're looking for shows to not renew and or cancel and not pick up. And that's where we were. We were on that line, and it was just easier for them to say no.
Right, and it's not just them, obviously. This is the case in most of the streamers.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, we can talk about Amazon Prime and Netflix, and each of them have different sort of brand identities and what they're looking for. And a lot of those don't have anything to do with necessarily quality or shows you want to watch. And then... what's really everyone seems to be looking for, which is amazing, you talk about the pendulum swinging back, is this idea of blue sky procedurals, which was the USA brand for a couple of years. And then you couldn't get arrested with a blue sky procedural at USA. Now everybody wants it. It's so crazy. And Jose, how has it changed in terms of selling a pilot? Because of course, it used to be you walk into a room with an executive that you met with many times, you tumbled a little bit, you're in their office, and you maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you either know if you sold it or not, right? Now you have to go in with a sort of master's doctorate, you know, where the show is going. You have to have, a video and, basically have made the pilot on your own. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how things have changed?
Yeah, I mean, you also have to come in half the time with attachments. If you don't have a star, you need a director. And God bless you if you're trying to come in without IP, because everybody wants IP. And then back it up a step, the producers have this IP and they're going out with IP, but they're going out to 4, 5, 6 writers. So you're trying to get this IP. You're competing with a bunch of other people. So every writing assignment, every open writing assignment is a bake-off. So it used to be you'd get a pilot, you'd sell a pilot, you'd shoot a pilot, you'd get it on the air, you'd get canceled. That was sort of the life of development. Now you have to go through all these crazy steps just to get the pilot sold, just to get the script sold. But I want to sort of pivot into another part of this, which is the world of staffing. I'm on a show right now that I'm really enjoying, that I'm hoping we'll get a second season. But we're finishing up The Room now. We'll start shooting in July, finish shooting in December, post through March-ish, air early summer. If there is a season 2, it'll be late next summer. So in success, this gig that I'm on, I'm still going to have to find 2 or 3 jobs before my next gig. And that's, what I've been finding the last handful of years is that you're constantly hustling. There isn't the thing that there used to be, which I think, Amy, you have the blessing right now of being on a Law & Order show. You can do 20 of those.
That's why I took the job.
Yeah, right. I was on a Law & Order a million years ago, and you would do your episodes, then you'd go on hiatus, then you'd come back, you'd do it again. Those days are long gone.
Right, right. What you're alluding to is now with 10 episode orders or less, 8, that you could finish, and a lot of these visual effects intensive shows, you're going to have a great experience on a TV show. It's over, and even if it's picked up, it may be a year, year and a half later that it goes back into production. So you have to work, take other gigs. Yeah. You may not even be available to come back even if they want to bring you back.
Right.
And that's a challenge. Slim, you've been lucky because you have worked on, obviously, Timeless, which was heartbreaking for you when it was canceled, but then you went to The Boys, which has been a fantastic experience. And that's the flip side of a good streaming experience. Obviously, that's a show that not only has Amazon has consistently renewed, but they've spun off. It's been a big success. You've had a great experience. And they recognize your value as a writer going to set. You've been able to, not just be in the writer's room, but you've gone and you've learned a lot being on set. Can you tell us a little bit about what your perception of the world we're talking about is, streaming versus network, and just sort of, how your career maybe has been a little different?
Yeah, mine has been really different, because I came up, as an actor first, and I kind of got lucky in this with the pilot that I wrote that got sold and then got me on to work with you for the first time.
On Agent X, yeah.
On Agent X. And my feeling is, because of not only the acting background but also the visual art background that I had, I kind of come into this as like an artist, so I don't make the most intelligent decisions. Like, a smart decision is to work on like a Law & Order or a Chicago series, something that's consistent, could provide food and shelter for my children. Shut up, Siri. Seriously.
What did she find? What did she find?
I don't know what she found. She found me a job. So I've said no a lot. And I've just been very fortunate where I got to work with Sean Ryan on something that I thought was interesting, which was timeless. And there met Eric Kripke, who created Supernatural. And hit it off with him. And then when he was going into The Boys, he was like, you know, come along. But not just come along, but when he showed me the pilot, I just saw what you could do with the metaphor. Even though I'm like a superhero geek and have that background, I have other interests, but I saw that you could use that metaphor, you know, to do something awesome. You know what I'm saying? So I don't necessarily have an issue with the streaming. I just have an issue with bad content. You know what I mean? And just like you were saying about like these studios or streaming services or whatever who are not giving shows their chance. I mean, today you couldn't have a Seinfeld. That first season, they would have canceled it. They'd be like, that doesn't work. You know what I mean? So many shows, probably fucking, sorry. probably like even like Sopranos or like really great shows that
Breaking
like
Bad.
Breaking Bad, you know what I mean? It's just like, so it's a very weird sort of like existence we're all kind of moving into. There's a lot of uncertainty. I'm not sure where it goes. I mean, you know, everything kind of, we're here. And things will start to gradually get to another place once the studios, like, you know, now that they've been slapped by their greed and can start figuring things out. But it's an uncertain time. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, you know, that leads into this whole idea of, you know, taking control of your own destiny. So I want to ask a little bit about this, which is, it used to be you could go into a room, you pitch, you know, pilot, or you write a spec, and, you know, basically you'd either sell it or you wouldn't. And, you know, now I know some of you, you know, have sort of taken that destiny in your own hands. Mark, you just did a short film. Slim, you just did a short film. Jeff, obviously, you know, you got a ton of attention virally when you and Adam cut that amazing Star Wars montage.
You and Topher.
You and Topher, right, yeah. Of course. And which was phenomenal. So my question to you guys is like, is it not, it's not enough anymore to just have an agent and write good material. You need to think outside the box, and you're a brand. You got to introduce yourself as a brand. I mean, Mark, is that part of the impetus for you doing your short film?
Part of the impetus of me doing a short film was I had precious little time on a set. Like in the streaming universe, the way that these rooms work is, you know, you show up on day one, you work for 20 weeks, you muster out of whatever show that is, and then you try to get the next job, and you're not there for production. You're not there for post. You're not there for all of the parts of making TV that are vital to have to arm you to eventually run your own show. And so I knew that I wasn't getting that stuff through the work I was doing. So, and it took Bear McCreary to remind me of this, that like, oh, you made an opportunity to get the experience you didn't have. Like, you know, it was one of a couple of different reasons why I made a short, mostly because, you know, I had a story I wanted to tell and had no other means to tell it. But yeah, the like putting some tools in the toolbox, knowing that I would need them going forward, and creating a venue to teach myself a thing.
Yeah. And Jeff, for you, it was a little different because you started as an editor. But, you know, obviously a lot of the work you were doing was getting a lot of attention. And then you were working with other showrunners to create, you know, sales reels, sizzle reels to help sell. Can you tell us what that process was like and how it helped you sell your show?
Yeah, so I have a crazy path to have gotten here. But I came out to Hollywood to be a trailer editor. Someplace saw my work that I was putting online, just dumb little videos. I was recutting movies to music, to songs that you never knew were those movies. You know, The Shining with the Shine On song by John Lennon. Or the Sabotage with All the President's Men.
So like, you're that guy?
I'm that guy. So it started getting attention.
As long as you didn't put Sabotage in a Star Trek movie, we're good.
That's funny. So I came out here and I was working at a trailer house and I hated it. I was just a cog in a machine, sneaking out at 8:30 at night, and people were like, hey, did you watch Ice Age 6? And I was like, I have not. I want to go home. And they're like, oh, well, we might have a call, and notes, so you have to stay. And I just hated that and I left. But I had friends who were sort of already in the system, and they're like, hey, I have this idea for this thing that I want to do. do you have any interest in cutting something? So people do scissors all the
time. By the way, I like what you said already in the system. It's the same thing they say in The Wire about people who are in jail. Already in the system, but you're talking about
and there,
television.
There were drugs, too, and so... but yeah, so I went... my friend was pitching a movie to Legendary. He had made Trick or Treat, and now he had a Christmas movie idea. And he's like, can you cut something? And I was like, yeah, sure, let's cut something. I get it. Cut it together. It sold to Legendary. It became Krampus. And Legendary started hiring... They're like, that's great. We're going to make this movie. Who made that? And they started hiring me to sell their shows. Here's an elevator pitch. Here's a treatment. Here's a, you know, whatever. Maybe a pilot, a script. Can you cut something together? So my sensibility, what a piece of music that they were going to go into a meeting. Carnival Row was one of them. And from there, it was just a word of mouth thing. I can't even put these things online because they're, you know, I'm using whatever music I want. I don't have the rights. I'm cutting with every movie I want. It's not like they're shooting anything, but it became this really valuable tool, and people just started calling me. And yeah, my friends were like, we have this idea about, it's like you like the Karate Kid, like we like the Karate Kid. We don't know if anyone else knows the Karate Kid, but our idea is like they're grown up now and they still are at it. And I'm like, well, that's a very awesome idea. I don't know how to cut that because they're not in a lot of things these days. But I found 6 things that they were in and cut this thing together, and it sold in every room. Amazing. And or they just had to, it was up to them to decide. They went with YouTube, and then that's another story. But I was watching, the Goldbergs was another one. Sorry, I don't want to hog everything. But Goldbergs, my pal from college, said, I have an idea for a show. I have tons of home movies about my family. It's like the Wonder, I'm like, I get it. It's the Wonder Years, but instead of looking back with wonder, you're looking back with horror. I totally get it. So you cut to Grieg, you know, dun, 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 dun. And it's just real footage of Adam and his family, VHS footage of them yelling at each other. It is the show. That was another one, just sold in the room. And Sony started hiring me to sell their shows. And I was like, well, this is great for you guys. Adam's like, I just put in a new pool next to my old pool. Well, this is awesome. And so finally I was like, well, I'm gonna try to sell my idea. Yeah. I'm a huge Muppet fan. I love the band. I'm like, they should have an album and a television show. And so I cut this thing together using footage from all the Muppet movies and showed it to Adam because he's my Muppet pal in arms. And he's like, oh, we are totally making this. I have a deal with Sony, so I can't pitch anything there. But if you, let's see what happens. He left Sony. He got a deal with Disney. That was his priority. You can only pitch to one studio. That's Muppets. And then you can only pitch to one streamer, and that's Disney Plus. Fortunately, they liked it, and we made it. And so I come in here with no professional writing credits, just my videos, I suppose, and just got this thrill ride, you know? I'm co-EP and co-creator and just in every meeting giving notes on all these things that I've grown up loving and, you know, taking a huge interest in and winning an Emmy. It's nuts, but yeah, I mean, just having the editing and the trailer, like I just knew no executive wants to read anything. As a creator, and you guys tell me if you agree, like no one, you don't want to leave it to the imagination of people who are oftentimes imaginationless. Yeah. But if you can show them exactly what you see and with a piece of music and a trailer gives you cards, so you could use that. You know, one man, one map, one mystery, you know? Like you spell it out to them. Everyone understands that language. But if that music leaves them with the feeling you want, then you just have a better chance of selling something. It's a living, you know, mood board, whatever.
You were asking earlier how is pitching a show different? That's a way in which it's different.
Yeah, but 100%. Also, I'd like to. You're the one responsible for giving us homework now.
Yeah,
it's like you created this whole. I mean, congratulations to you. But everybody's like, do what he did, and then it's like, I ain't got that. I don't have those editing skills.
I'm available for hire. Right. You know what? Like the Stranger Things guys.
The strikes were hard.
Stranger Things guys went in with. Have you ever seen that documentary?
Yeah.
It's insane.
The Wachowskis with the Matrix.
Totally. Yeah. You just have to, it's not about grabbing, I mean, it's somewhat grabbing their attention. You know, when we pitched to Disney, funny enough, we had Muppet Studios on our side. We did it over Zoom. It was during the pandemic. We had the Muppets break into the Zoom. And so all of a sudden in this meeting, you have like, and so I'm just saying, if you guys can get the Muppets.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. All
right. That is so not fair, man. Goddamn Muppets.
I could just see it now. For everything we pitch, the Muppets will just break in. Yes, Star Wars show? No, Star Trek, the Muppets. The Godfather TV series, the Muppets. Sarah, we were first doing these panels, I think you were on the Middlemen. Could you imagine having a conversation? I couldn't imagine having a conversation 5 years ago.
Yay! You're the one.
I mean, this is a great example of how dramatically this process has changed. And so when people, you know, are giving these seminars or these classes and they're talking about, you know, writing, you know, specs and getting an agent, that's not...
It's not how it works anymore.
Not how it works anymore.
I don't have an agent. No,
smart. Really? Yep. No, and also I think that this whole visual thing is, you know, these sizzle reels, I'm never going to do that, but I've had to learn how to do these pitch decks, which never in my career did I want to do, but I worked with a company who said they're like, we have these great in-house people, and they'll like do it all for you. And it was like a picture of an actor in front. It was like so bad I cried. And my husband, who teaches eighth grade, is like, well, I could teach you Google Slides in about 5 minutes. So I learned, and now I like spend more time on these pitch decks, which I personally kind of love doing. I call it the arts and crafts portion of pitching. But there's a couple reasons why I think those are actually very helpful, because I was very bitter about the fact that we all had to start doing these pitch decks, because it's not what our skill set is. But I do think it makes it so much easier for the executives to see. If you're good at it, you give this visual representation of your work, and also Zoom. Pitching on Zoom is death. And like you said, pitches used to be at about 10 minutes. Now they're 30 to 40. And it's ridiculous. And to sit on a Zoom listening to somebody talk, and they know in the first couple minutes if they're going to buy it or not, you're just, it's death pitching these things. And so the pitch deck does give you this visual and helps hold the executive's attention, because you can tell when they're tuning out and like looking at their phones, where you used to be in the room with these people and you get to have conversations and crosstalk, and it's a whole different process.
Yes. Do you like pitching in person more than you like pitching over Zoom?
What?
Do you like pitching in person better
Absolutely.
Than over Zoom? Because
yeah.
I've talked to a lot of people, and I'm actually one of them, that I'd rather do it on Zoom.
Because you can just read it.
Because I can just have the document up and I'm never getting lost. Oh,
but true. I've always, yeah. I will say that even in person, I take the document in with me and I feel no shame about it.
Yeah, and I'm not an actor. Yeah. I'm like, this yeah. is...
Well, Sarah's like, just more charming than the rest of us. So I prefer Zoom.
It's also a nerve-wracking experience to pitch. And like, especially I pitched to Steven Spielberg for the Goonies thing. And I knew that I might actually black out and go into like... some sort of fugue state. And so just knowing that if I had to, I could just look down and read word for word, I was like, okay, I'm golden. Yeah.
See, I'm with you, Sarah. I preferred going in and
the
pitching.
Energy.
And it used to be, was you used to pitch in their office and you would see like the pictures of what movies and TV shows they had up, what books they had on their bookshelf, what their kids looked like. There was always something way
Spielberg
in.
Oh, Spielberg has the E.T. camera.
And then it became conference rooms. Then it became like you go and it would just be a generic conference room. And that was sort of utilitarian and not as much fun because there was nothing there. And then it became Zoom, and it was like, because now they, A, could get right into it. There's no small talk.
No small talk.
And then they can get off of it whenever they, oh, my assistant, oh, emergency, oh, my God, my kid dropped coffee on them at McDonald's, and I'm out. You know, it's like whatever. And it's just so, and you can't read the room. It's
no,
so
you're
frustrating.
Right. It used to be so much more personal. Also, for the Goonies Project, I got to pitch it to Richard Donner, the director of the movie, which was such an honor, because Goonies is like... I mean, it's so amazing. And I pitched in his office, and One-Eyed Willie's skull was on the coffee table next to me. And we were able to have this just great conversation about movies for about 30 minutes before I pitched. And I feel like I had sold it even before I gave the pitch, just because we hit it off so well.
One thing that's awful about Zoom, I had this pitch that I was taking out, and we were talking about doing a pitch deck. And every couple of minutes, I'll throw up an image and it'll be great. They'll have a visual sense of what I'm talking about. And my producer was like, no, don't do that, because you rob them of their screen. And a lot of the times while they're listening to pitches, they're checking their emails, they're checking, they're updating their calendars. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. It's like chatting in the middle of an audition. At least to have the decency to pay 30 minutes worth of attention, which if you're in person, nobody, I mean, God help them, nobody's doing this.
But a friend
some people do.
A friend of ours who was on the on this panel in the past told me that they were pitching and the executive was in the car taking on their phone, taking the pitch in the car. And it was like, how disrespectful. But it's so funny because what have you learned from this panel so far? You don't need a master's degree in English. You need to have graduated kindergarten now to be a writer so you can put together these arts and crafts projects to sell your show. We've really taken a step back, haven't we? So tell us about, I mean, and then I want to move to actually producing, but there's this bifurcation in the business right now. Amy, you're sort of the outlier working on a network show, and Derek, obviously, with Quantum, but we're these longer series artists. But you have the really super expensive shows, which I imagine Percy Jackson is one of those. And then you have what everybody's now, they don't want to call them cheap shows, but economically, what is the word now they're using?
Responsible?
Economically responsible, that which is basically...
We are saying, not economically responsible, yeah, Percy.
You're saying we want cheap shows, but we don't want to call them cheap. But still quality, but economically responsible. So tell us how that has maybe impacted you as writers or not, and sort of, again, where we are in the industry as producers, showrunners, creators, writers. Jose, what do you think?
What's funny is that this show that I'm on right now is a Netflix show, and it is sort of economically responsible, but it's still $10 million an episode.
That's not economical.
Yeah.
That's, by streaming standards, it's not Lord of the Rings, House of the Dragon money. So they consider it sort of
like
a mid-range show. And it's crazy. You, with all this money, you're still having conversations about... one of the principals, one of the leads of the show can't have a house. He can have a bedroom in the house and we can show the bedroom, but we can't show his living room or his kitchen because we can't afford to build them. So you're still...
So he's living in an RV now.
Yeah. No, we're literally talking about giving him an RV. But you're still having these crazy conversations about what you can and what you can't do. And I think what's happening is that because there's more and more auspices behind every show... a lot of the money is going uphill rather than into the production.
Yeah. Because there are more and more producers, and a lot of these executives who get fired because there's been a lot of downsizing, they're given production deals. Yeah. And what's funny is they know nothing about producing, but then they become producers on the show and pocket big salaries but aren't really contributing much.
And the other thing is more and more you're seeing these streaming shows launch with movie stars or former movie stars. Yeah. Who take a big salary for their acting services, mm-hmm. and on top of that, they'll take a producer salary as well. So you have more money, but you really don't.
Yeah, and other above the line, you also have money going to an IP likely,
right,
that you're licensing, that you're paying for, and so much isn't showing up on screen. So what about you, Amy? What do you think about the way that, because you produced some pilots, you worked with Dean, who is very economically responsible, mm-hmm. On Leverage, and now he has rebooted that show very successfully for Amazon. What do you see the difference? Because you've worked on very cheap shows and then very expensive shows.
Economically responsible. No, I've ping-ponged. Like, I mean, I'm Law and Order Organized Crime is considered very economically responsible. But I came off of that Jack Ryan, which was probably the least economically responsible television show. It was the number one show in the world. It was Amazon. Literally, they would tell us, can we go to Italy for that? Is that cool with you guys? Yes.
But isn't that an advantage you have? People think, writing is just about writing, but it's not. You're also doing the line of the line producer.
Oh, yeah.
You got to understand, like, what you can afford to do and what you can't. And that makes you a valuable commodity as opposed to somebody who has to be rewritten, not because they're not a great writer, but because they don't understand budget, and they're writing these shows that are unproducible.
Yeah, I call it writing inside a box, which is basically writing to a budget, but without limiting yourself creatively. There are ways to do that where you're actually challenging yourself in a way that you find something better than you might have otherwise if you had the money for it. One of my favorite things to do is trap characters because it forces them into situations that reveal themselves. And you know, so you could put people on a run on a city street in Rome or trap them in an elevator. You're going to find more about them by trapping them in an elevator. So there are ways to write economically that are actually better creatively. Yeah. And so you just got to take those opportunities when they come.
Derek, you started as a writer's assistant. Do you think that was sort of a great incubator for you finding out reasonably budgeted show, Andromeda, you know, working for Robert.
It was called syndication. But
the first run, the old days of first run syndication. Yeah. And now we're pining away for those days. That at the time it was like, oh, what the hell? And now it's like, yeah. Oh, first run syndication, remember that? So did you learn a lot in that hard, fast crucible of being a writer's assistant? And also what, you know, how you write a script that is producible for a limited budget?
Sure, I mean, you observe and as a writer's assistant, you're watching these writers pull their hair out as they're trying to figure out how to write in a box. Because most of the time, you know, writing the bottle episode is the most expensive episode. Yeah. It's like you start out with the intent of like making sure that this is an episode where we're going to be able to afford and do and all. And it ends up costing more somehow every single time. And, you know, since we don't have the luxury of going to Italy on Quantum, I was like, we go to Italy on the Universal backlot. You know, it's like we're going to go to this country on the Universal backlot.
Like, so. Blood.
Not unlike the $6 million man did.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. So you learn very quickly how, you know, especially, you know, I would say in the days of Andromeda versus now, not much has changed other than the players. But because, again, it's all about the bean counters. It's about, you know, saying who can spend what. For for Quantum, like there are times where we have to do 7-day shoots. I mean, normally we get 8-day shoots, but if you get that 7-day, then you have to be very crafty on how to write to 7 days to make sure that you're going to make your budget on time and deliver a script. And also because it's network, it's going to be airing very quickly versus streaming you have a luxury of and sort of the, you know, the downfall of it of waiting a lot to be able to shoot because there's a lot of writing. And then you have you have all the scripts, then you're rewriting, then you have the scripts again. And sometimes they get rid of the writers, bring in new writers, and then you have the scripts. Whereas in network television, once that train's out the station, it's go time. You have no time other than, you know, unless there's a disruption like a strike that will, you know, give you time to, you know, catch your breath. So yeah, it's like at being a writer's assistant, you learn very quickly of like, oh, understanding that while you have all these amazing ideas, especially for a sci-fi show, you think that you can do everything. It's like, no, actually, you can do less. You can do a lot less, you know, but you have to. And you still have to, you know, so be creative in so many different ways. And so watching that happen firsthand, you know, experience, but it wasn't until, you know, being actually, you know, staffed on a show that you really, because there's only so much you can learn as a writer's assistant because you're assisting. But it's not until you're actually, you know, faced with that script that you have to write and deliver. That's where it really sort of the rubber, you know, hits the road.
Yeah. And I know, Jose, you started as a writer's assistant also. Oh, yeah, of course. Go ahead.
I didn't start as a writer's assistant. I was just incredibly naive for a very long time. And there's this one episode of Timeless that I remember where I was making that mistake of dreaming too big. And it was this Robert Johnson episode, and I wanted to do this thing where Robert is going down the road with the time team, and you saw the Thanos. Feels.
No,
it wasn't even like that. It was just like cinematic. It was like you saw the feels, you know, people picking cotton and then going to the chain gang and then just kind of just like doing the journey of soul to rock and roll through this one piece. And I was just like, we're fucking doing it. We're doing it. And they were just like, no, we're not. And it started to get pared down, until finally we just didn't even do it. But that was like a, and it didn't matter because the story worked on its own. But for me, and just like in my, you know, just like wanting to be, fuck, you know, Orson Welles or, you know what I mean? Or do like this big thing, I've had to learn how to just kind of, what is most important for the story?
Yeah.
And not what is most important for like, you know, some visual.
That makes you a better writer.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, I came of age as a person who tells stories in the 80s, you know, and the movies that I loved were like Aliens and The Terminator and The Road Warrior, and none of them had any fucking money, right? So it's how do you do Aliens for $16 million? Like, how do you make it feel big? And Cameron knew some shit about some shit. Like, he knew rear projection. He knew everything was going to be practical because we're in 1984 making this movie. Looking at Terminator, like, it's all on the page. Like, we had enough money for one sequence in the future, but everything else becomes evocative, right? It becomes Doctor Who, which is the greatest example of in-the-box storytelling ever. Like, we have no money ever, and haven't for 50 years. Like, it's a dude in a box, and we carry the box around, and we're going to Cardiff. And so we're on some street that kind of looks old, we're on a street that doesn't, and that's it. So how do you conjure these images in the audience's head? And that's the exercise, right? That's economically frugal, responsible storytelling on a grand imaginative scale. Is all right, it's a blue box, and he's got a screwdriver. What's it do? It's a screwdriver. Trust me, does everything. Are we ever going to see it do anything? No. It's going to do me, wee, wee, wee. That's it.
And sometimes the sound is off screen.
Jose, you worked as a writer's assistant, and obviously that led to a lot of great opportunities. But what do you think the important lessons you learned at that stage in your career were? What were the takeaways?
I was really lucky. I was Howard Gordon's assistant for about 3 years, and I started with him while he was at the beginning of a development deal. So I got to see a show go from pitch to pilot to hiring a director for the pilot to casting that pilot, shooting that pilot, posting that pilot, testing that pilot, getting it on the air, and getting canceled 8 days later. So I got to see the whole journey from inception to cancellation. And, you know, one of the things that is hard to accept as creative people is that to the networks, for the most part, to the execs, what you're giving them is product. You're giving them your heart and your soul and your creativity and every ounce of blood, sweat, and tears that you have. But for them, they used to be slaves to the Nielsens. Now they're slaves to the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to learn not to take it, and this is the 8-day cancellation, not to take it too personally, because there can be an executive that loves your show and is going to fight for your show, but ultimately it's product, and they're going to have to make a decision based on math rather than heart. And that was a really tough lesson to learn, and I railed against it for years, but it is what it is. I got, you know, Firefly got canceled, Agent Carter got canceled. Those are, yeah, some of my favorite shows that I worked on went away. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I was livid, and I was like, there is no justice in Hollywood. It's like, that's damn right, kid, there is no justice in Hollywood.
The perfect example of that is if anybody watched Barry, there's a character that has a show, and then she goes into like what is like a Netflix, and it is the show premiered the night before, and it was canceled the next day. And she was like, "What do you?" They're like, "We, you know, it's the algorithm. We can't do anything about it. You know, I wish there was something. If there was somebody of higher responsibility, it's like, but you're the president. It's like, but the algorithm. We have to trust the algorithm. It is so cringing because it's so true. And it's what Jose said. It's like there's all. It's just number crunching." And it sucks, and I know that Amy could, you know, share that experience.
But also, also the algorithm is bullshit.
It is.
Yeah. It's bullshit.
It is.
All this algorithm, everything, and then the show comes on, and nobody watches because it has no heart.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And also, I think a big, let's applaud that. A big reason for the shift, too, is that the people who are in charge now aren't people who got there because they love movies and TV. Yeah. Yes. They got there because they're number people. Mm-hmm. And so it really has sucked a lot of the passion out. And like, we feel that vibe.
That's a huge point. That's a very, very well important point, because it used to be you meet with executives who love what they do, like Chris Parnell, right? And just love movies, love television, know the history of the medium. And now it's a bunch of MBAs who are experts in algorithms, you know? And
it's a perfect reason why AI should replace executives before they replace writers.
And, you know, it's interesting because I want to get to AI, obviously, because that's a big issue for all of us. And will unfortunately continue to be, you know, when we talk about this whole algorithm, what's interesting, it used to be if you got ratings, you stayed on the air, but now the streamers have a different metric that they want. They want to sell subscriptions, so it's not necessarily about, oh, if you're getting good ratings in season 5, we're going to pick you up for season 6. Is it attracting any new subscribers? Yeah. So they're better off canceling that show and starting a new show that's going to attract new subscribers, then keep an old show that's doing well on the air, which upends the entire model, which was like, well, in success, you move on, you know? And that's not necessarily the case everywhere anymore. It's still that way in network, but it's not that way in the streamers.
Yeah, that's what killed Warrior Nun. I mean, it wasn't that we didn't have enough people watching. It was that they already all had Netflix. And that was the algorithm they were using. We did fantastic numbers, but we weren't bringing in any new people.
I thought they unkilled it.
Netflix didn't unkill it. Okay. The fans unkilled it. And then the rights to the IP went to a Canadian company and didn't involve any of us. And then now the fans are in an uproar again about that. So,
so it is being made again?
It in a series of 3 movies of some kind.
With
awesome. I don't think it's any of the actors or any of the writers. So but it's what the algorithm wants. Yeah. No, it's not Netflix. It's something.
What's interesting though, I'm wondering now when you're talking about the pendulum swinging back, because now that all these are doing ad-supported streaming, right, and all the commercials, like how is that going to change the conversation? Because they're going to need to have shows remain on if they're going to be doing, like Amazon for the first time is going to the upfronts this year. Amazon, they're going to the upfronts.
Yeah, because they've added advertising.
Yeah.
And Netflix has added advertising and Disney Plus. So in a way, it's counterintuitive. You think, oh, they're adding advertising. That sucks. It may be a good thing. Because ratings may become more important, because now they kind of have to show the ratings to the advertisers.
They have to open their books.
They have to, So
because we're reinventing cable slowly and clumsily.
Yeah. So, sorry. This was a lot of bringing it down. I know it's raining, it's miserable, everybody's cold. So it's like, we got to turn the aircraft carrier around and get a little more upbeat. So I want to go back to sort of how you broke into the industry and kind of what your advice, and maybe it's changed for the new writer today. And then I want to open it to questions, but let's try and, you know, we've sort of laid it out there. This was sort of a therapy session, I think, for all of us about the state of the industry. Yeah. But let's try and inspire the new generation of writers a little more.
Are you sure about that? Have you seen the landscape?
It's going to get better. It will.
That's what we keep telling ourselves. Mark, go ahead.
I will preface this with a caveat that breaking into TV is a lot like breaking out of prison. No two people do it the same way, and they always seal up the hole after they get out. So your mileage may vary. I was a journalist first for 20 years, and then started writing comic books, and one of those comics got the attention of an agent who was like, I can make this a TV show. And I said, I'd like to see you try. And he failed miserably. But then was like, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to write TV. And he said, well, write a pilot, come out to LA for meetings, and if you get on a show, you have to move here in 72 hours, which is basically what happened. I wrote a pilot that's awful now that I read it today. I came out to LA for a week, took a shit ton of meetings, didn't get shows that I desperately wanted that I'm glad I now didn't get, like The Cape. I wanted so badly to be on The Cape and figure out how The Cape fought crime without a person on it. Do you guys remember The Cape?
Yes.
Yeah, that one. That's the one I wanted more than anything. But then I ended up getting on Alphas, and Alphas kind of began a career, which was amazing, and got to learn how to do it from people who like really knew how to do it. But my advice, I suppose, would be write your asses off, continue to write, find peers that are in your community, share your work, make some stuff. You know, I don't think the days of, like, I wrote a bunch of pilots, give me a job, are really viable anymore. Make a short film. Make a scripted podcast. Make a thing, because now you can make things way easier than you could have when I was trying to break in. And for executives who hate reading, like, looking at something is, I think, way more valuable these days. It's a way to sort of captivate their attention and maximize your capability in front of them. And so make some shit. Do some shit and keep writing, because you're only ever going to get better. It's hard, but you're going to have to get kicked in the nuts a lot, or the ovaries a lot, or the nethers or betweens a lot, before there's any crack in the wall.
Yeah. What about you, Derek?
Yeah, the way that I got in, I started out pretty much like everyone in here. I was a fan first. I was sitting out here in you know, convention halls and panels, you know, watching people. So I, on a chance encounter, met Ashley at another convention, and he was just starting to write on Andromeda. And so we struck up a conversation, and I did that thing that you're not supposed to do that they always say is like, hey, can you read my screenplay? And he read it, and then we just met once a week, and he unofficially became my mentor, and then about 6 months
into it. But that's a terrible example of breaking in, because no one is like Ashley who will actually do that.
It's like, oh, there are a lot of people that do that.
He'll talk to everybody and read
the script. Yeah, there are people that do that. I mean, look, you're going to get a lot of no's to get to that yes, but, you know, that's everything in life. He 6 months later called me up and said, like, hey, the writer assistant's leaving. I think you got a good shot at becoming the writer assistant. You should come in and do an interview. And to this day, it's the most daunting interview. It felt like a tribunal, because it was Robert Wolf and all the writers sitting in a semicircle. And I'm sitting in this chair, and they're grilling me, you know, why I want to be a writer's assistant.
Four lights.
Yes, very much so. I ended up getting the job. And then that was where my, you know, my sort of like understanding of how television work first began. So I would say, like I said, this is, you know, so different these days of, like, even just getting a writer's assistant job. Writer's PA is such a coveted position. And if you're not, you know, unfortunately, if you're not living in Los Angeles, if you're not, you know, networking, talking to people, it is very difficult to get into that, you know, into those rooms.
Soon they're going to have to do a pitch deck to be writer's assistant.
Pretty much. Yeah, exactly. So, but to, like, Mark's point, you know, there are so many ways to be creative these days. I was like, if I had a tenth of the things that were available, I still wouldn't do them because I'm just so lazy. But I would say, for those that aren't lazy, it's like there's so many different ways to just get your story told. But at the end of the day, it's just you have to write. You have to write. That's it. If you want to be a writer, you have to write. Nothing else matters. All these glorified book reports and everything, guess what? You're still writing. So just write. But again, there's so many videos out there. Everything's at your fingertips these days. And just also, you know, don't be afraid to talk to people. This is a relationship business.
Yeah. Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy. I cannot believe how much the industry has changed since I broke in. It's truly wild. So I also started out as a writer's assistant, which was great, learned a ton, and was able to meet people that way. And this was back in the day when of network shows where they would, with 22 episodes, they had legally had to give freelance episodes, and usually those would go to the support staff. So I got incredible opportunities that unfortunately just have dried up. And then I also came up in the days when we wrote specs of existing shows. So I had a Gilmore Girls and a Six Feet Under, and then ultimately got staffed on Parenthood. So it was sort of a dream come true to get to, you know, the stars of both of those shows were in Parenthood. And it was amazing. But, you know, I got an agent through a chance encounter like everybody does. It's, you know, meeting people. And if anyone listens to Kraft and Fain's podcast, Happiness in Hollywood, I think they always give fantastic advice that groups of people, friends tend to rise up together, which I think is so true. You think your big break is going to be like the person 10 steps above you, but it's likely going to be your group of friends. And that's what happened with me. I had a friend who worked for an agent, read my script, really liked it, gave it to their boss, and then I got signed. And so it really is those lateral connections. Don't underestimate those. And also those are going to be your lifeline, your friends, who, you know, I feel so like old saying this, but it's my birthday, so I'm reflecting a lot. But, you know, there is such a joy in when you're starting out as a writer and finding the first stories you love and writing the first thing you're proud of and having your friends read it. And at the time, I just wanted so desperately to make it. And now I look back and I'm like, those were the good old days. So really do. I feel like we have been a lot of doom and gloom, but writing is still the best thing ever. And you get to feel so good even when you're not making money doing it. So enjoy the journey. That's my old lady advice.
Oh, and I would add writing programs. There are a lot of great writing programs that also can help break into this business.
What about you, Slim?
I will first start by saying I hate writing. Loathe it. It hurts. It kills. It makes me incredibly insecure. My journey has been, I talked a little bit, I mentioned a little bit a little while ago, but again, I have an art background. I think I told you this, but like in 11th grade, Image Comics offered me a job to illustrate. My mom said no. But I had the art background. I was supposed to become an interior designer. Fucked around and ended up at Florida State and started acting. And but that's when the writing started. And so as I was an actor going into New York and doing like off Broadway plays until finally off Broadway and then like some films at Sundance, I continued writing and watching films. And for me, that's what is really like, you know, energizes me. And especially this last 2023 was a great year in cinema. And finally, I'm like, okay, it's back. But that led to, I wrote a pilot and I got my first job. It sold, got first job, and it's kind of made things continue like that. But I think for everybody who's like interested in doing this, it is, you could say it's harder, but it's just different. Everything evolves, you know what I mean? I was lucky that I used to do sizzle reels. I also used to do storyboards for directors, I've been in front of and behind the camera in indie films. And so I just love this shit, you know what I mean? And
the Nuremberg rallies are happening next door. What is that? What? Right. Did you hear? It was just like all this cheering and.
Oh, Jesus Christ. And then Wolverine walks in.
Coincidence?
But if you want to do this, just go to your passion. My journey is different. You can see everybody's journey is totally different. But if you can like lead by that passion of wanting to tell that story that only you can tell, and even you might, these guys are like huge. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't know why I'm at this table. You know, and I constantly go into rooms in that way. Even in my writer's rooms, I'm just like, oh, these guys are better than me. These guys are better than me. Because they dedicate to that. You know what I mean? But I have something that they don't. You know what I mean? You guys have something that they don't. I was talking to this writer's group and this pair. They have Asperger's and but they're artists as well. And they were just like, well, we don't think we should put as much detail as far as like in our action. It's too visual. And I'm just like, no. Lean into that. If they tell you to pull back, let them tell you to pull back, but don't censor yourself. You know what I'm saying? So just go for that thing. And do it in how whatever skills and styles and make yourself awesome. You know what I mean? Like the Quiet Place script. It was just a
a page. Nothing's on the fucking page. It just says he walks 5 steps more. And I'm just like, you can do that? You know what I mean? But it's just like, you gotta have, you know, the balls, the iron ovaries, the gumption to be like, I am going to put myself out there and F you. You know what I mean? And people may be like, okay, cool, come in. Or they may be like, okay, that's not for me. But then just move on. They just don't get you. And find the people, find the friends that you have that will then take you to that next spot.
Well, Slim, you just made a really great point. I think the one thing we haven't talked about, and we're going to continue, but is you have to have passion. Yeah. You have to have, because there's so many times in this industry that you're kicked down, or, you know, something gets rewritten, or an actor messes up your lines, you know, or there's a problem, you know, or a show doesn't get picked up when, you know, for a second season, or your pilot gets sold and you make it and you love it and it doesn't get, you know, so you gotta have passion. That's what carries you even through the dark times. So obviously you have that in ample abundance. And I have to say, I remember in the writer's room, you were an amazing artist. You would draw all this stuff while we were breaking stories, and it's just amazing artist. Great writer too, but amazing artist. And so it's just, it's so great to see how you've, you know, flourished since you were a staff writer on the show.
What does your mom say about you working on a comic book show now?
My mom is very religious, and she has not watched The Boys. Yo, I want to do like a YouTube channel, just me and my mom on the couch doing a reaction of every single episode of The Boys. And it's just going to be like comedy gold, man. And she's from Trinidad, too, so did you add the accent on there?
I created what? The bold type where the girls were having a lot of sexy time, and my mom was like, "Ooh,
why is that boy walking in that red tunnel?
Yeah.
What's it going to be? Oh, no.
This is how I raise you?
This is a whole panel. Just television shows we don't want our mom to watch.
Yeah.
That could be a two-hour panel.
I did a lot of prestige TV, and my parents are not allowed to watch a lot of what I've done.
And they watch it anyway, which is the really annoying part. Amy, let's continue with breaking in and how that could be potentially informative to today.
Yeah, passion and obsession is how I got my start. I moved to town when I was 22. I wrote, I will call it an episode of Buffy because I didn't know what a spec was at the time. But it was a spec of Buffy. And I had a job on a Nickelodeon show. And I went to the writers on the Nickelodeon show. I was like, so how do I get Joss to read this? And they were like, oh, sweetheart. And they patted me on the head. And they said, oh, you can't send him a script for his own show. There's legal stuff. So you're going to have to write something else. So I wrote a one-act play that featured Joss and the actors on Buffy as characters talking about how awesome I was. And I had some prop guys at Nickelodeon whittle some vampire steaks, and I bought some vampire teeth, and I put the one-act play in a box, and I sent it to Joss Whedon's office.
Said, make sure she's never allowed on the lot.
He said, I need to meet her tomorrow, is what he said after reading my one-act play. So my first meeting in town was with Joss Whedon when I was 22 years old. After the meeting, it took 2 hours because I had literally every scene of every pitch in my head. I named all the demons. It was very intense. And then I got a call that I was in the running. I was like, great, for what? Turned out it was staffing season. I had no idea it was staffing season. I did not end up getting the job. It went to some guy named Drew Goddard. The Nickelodeon writers came back to me, and basically in their heads, if Joss Whedon wanted to listen to what I had to say, maybe they should listen to what I had to say. And so they asked me to pitch for the show. I was in town for 6 months and I started writing for Nickelodeon because I was obsessed with Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So it's it's a cautionary tale now because that would be considered stalking. But
clearly it was my passion that got the attention. And that's what this is all about. I mean, I sort of hate that we can't write episodes of existing shows anymore. Like that the fact that that has gone away, I feel like has lost a lot of people their opportunities. Because it was my Buffy spec, and then it was my Lost spec I did during the first season of Lost that featured the point of view of the dog. I got offers on every single genre show that was on television after reading that Lost spec. If I had written a pilot, my first pilot was about a con man. I wouldn't have been in genre. So it's really like, you know, you got to write what you love. And honestly, I would read a spec of an existing show if someone gave me one. Like, I think it tells you a lot about who they are, what they love.
There's probably 10 more seasons of X-Files scripts out there. Just the
amount 100%.
Of spec scripts that people were writing in the 90s for X-Files.
Yeah. Yep.
Jeff, you sort of told us about your path to breaking in, but I don't know if you want to add to that and how it can be instructive to people.
Yeah, I would say connections. The people you know in networking were a huge part of how I got here. I went to NYU, which I didn't like as a college, but I liked for meeting. My roommate is my best friend, Brian K. Vaughan. I knew Adam Goldberg there, Mike Dougherty, and Kyle Newman. We all started doing stuff together. I went to a performing arts camp. I was a theater kid, right? So, like, my bunkmate was Jed Whedon. And I spent Christmas with the Whedons as Joss.
It sounds like a comedy.
In 10th grade and like...
really dysfunctional comedy.
It's so messy. Like Joss was just in...
really darkly.
Going into production of the Buffy movie then. But yeah, and then in college I also interned at Henson, at a trailer house, at a title house and a studio. And all those things and all the people I met there came back into my life all throughout. I mean, I wound up hiring people who I interned at Henson for, which is nuts, but like the trailer people, when I was out of Trailer Park, they started their own place and they were hiring me. A year out of Trailer Park, I won a Golden Trailer Award because they hired me. And it was a nice thing to go up on that stage and just be like, oh, hi, to Trailer Park. But again, just having like this little community of people you can call on, whether it's to read your stuff or when they need you or to cut a trailer to help them, I mean, it's the best.
Well, that reaffirms something that Sarah said earlier, which is everybody's looking to meet, you know, oh, I want to get in a meeting with Spielberg. I want to get in a meeting, you know, with John Wells. But it's really about your peers that you're coming up with, mm-hmm. right? And then if you have deep friendships, because those are the people you're going to call, even if you're a showrunner. Hey, somebody wants to be a writer on my show. Are they any good? Tell me the truth. You know, or they're fantastic. Great. Or they're the people you're going to want to hire. And they're the people that are going to support you when your show doesn't get picked up. I mean, look at this panel. We've been doing it. I'm not going to say how many years we've been doing it, but Sarah's only 29 now. We haven't been doing it that long. But, you know, we as a group, for the most part, have been doing this panel, you know, it's at Comic-Con and sometimes at WonderCon for many moons. And it's really important to have that those kind of friendships and that support structure. And, you know, obviously, in many cases, that shoulder to cry on when things are not going well. And people who understand what you're going through on a show that, you know, and dealing with the network. And, you know, you call them and say, I'm dealing with this executive now. Is this executive, you know, what should I know about them? What are the landmines? So it's so helpful. It's not just about trying to get to those people way above you, but have a relationship with people, you know, that you're coming up with as well. So that's a great point that you both made. So Jose, what about you? Did you ever have Christmas with the Whedons?
Thank God, no. I worked with Joss. That was plenty. I think these guys have really covered most of what I would say. The one little niche that I don't think we've talked about or talked about enough is internships and fellowships. Those are really good ways of, you know, write, do your work, and then submit. And that's how I got into this whole racket, was the TV Academy has a summer internship. And I got that, and they put me on Star Trek, which was, like, where I wanted to be, so it was crazy. And the other little piece of advice that I would offer, I'm going to toot my own horn. Me and my friend Javi Grillo-Marxwatz do a podcast called Children of Tendu, which talks a lot about what the TV industry is like, how to break in, how to stay in, how to thrive. So if you guys haven't checked it out, check it out.
Yeah, no, those are all great points. And also a lot of great diversity programs as well. And
yeah.
I mean, you look at the value. So many people have come out of these internship programs. I mean, you mentioned Star Trek. You know, Brandon Braga started as an intern and, you know, became a very successful showrunner and created many of the Star Trek shows later on. We only have a few minutes. If you want to line up by the mic, we can do a few questions before we wrap up. Go ahead.
Are we open?
We're okay. Open for questions, but not for very long because I'm getting the high stop soon. So
I'll
go ahead.
As fast as I can. Quick preamble: Kevin E. West, veteran television actor from Matlock to Righteous Gemstone. Sean's a friend of mine. Did Lost, all that. But I was also on the SAG-AFTRA negotiating committee, and the question has to do with where we are and where it might be headed in terms of the fact that FAST, which FAST ad-supported television streaming, is starting to begin to try, per Amazon being at the upfronts, starting to look like network television in terms of ad money. And my question for all of us, but for you guys, do you believe that the infusion of ad money into the streaming model, and whether or not they start bundling a lot between themselves, do you think that's going to help extend network television and cable or expedite its termination? And it's a two-part. Do you believe that it will actually help part of what's been discussed today, in that the streamers, if they start bundling and using ad money, will help us get some of those shows to actually get a second and a third and a fourth season, longer than what the model has become of just capturing subscribers? Which of those two do you think will happen because of ad money coming in? That's my question to the group.
Derek, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take this one. Because I'm on the board of directors for the WGA as well. So, and we've had a lot of conversations about this and watching where things are going. And I will say that, you know, in the crystal ball prediction of it, we don't know, because this is such an unpredictable environment. We are dealing with giant corporations, billions of dollars, and that money is going to them and not to us, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, but they still need to have an ecosystem in place, even though they try as they might, to, you know, trying to destroy it. And they need all of us. And so they need stories, they need shows, they need, you know, they need talent. So my long-winded way of saying is, like, signs hazy, ask again later. And I will say, though, as Mark was saying at the very beginning of this, of the pendulum swinging back to where it is going, I think that we're going to see more shows. They're going to need more shows. It's already happening. Like, streaming platforms are starting to extend. It's not no longer viable to have a 6 to 8 episode season, right? It's like they are now starting to do the 13. They're starting to do the 18. What is it? Daredevil was like at doing 18 episodes.
If you spend all this money to launch a show and then it's gone after 6. It's like, why spend all that money on marketing?
Right, and then so it's like, and subscribers are getting smart. Like, why am I subscribing to 4 different platforms if you're going to cancel a show after 1 season? Now, they're not going to invest in that, right? Viewers are going to be very much, you know, smarter. I've cut a lot of stuff out. Like, I've cut out Hulu. I've cut out Paramount Plus. I had all of them, but I'm like, I watch maybe 1 or 2 shows, and that's it. And I think that a lot of viewers are really becoming fatigued by how many more subscriptions are going to need. And so these companies are realizing that. And so how are they going to be able to keep people, you know, coming back? You need more shows. You need more episodes.
I'm afraid we only have time for one more question.
Sorry.
I got the old. So yeah, thank you.
Lou, who? Hey. So first off, I just want to do a shout out to Amy, because you're the first one on Twitter, I'm not going to say the other name, that gone through the 7-month writer strike as a captain. And I just want to say, what a trooper. Yeah. Just keeping through the storm. Keeping the writer strikes alive, because not only that, it only proved that writers not only provide the content, but you provide the soul to these shows.
Well, that's a great point. So let's get everybody's social media handles. So if you want to engage with them on social, starting with Mark and as we wrap things up.
I am at Mark Bernardin at every place that you could find a person except for the hellscape that we used to call Twitter.
Derek?
D Blackanese, IG, Blue Sky, and Zitter, but I don't go on Zitter.
Zither. Is that like the third man? Oh, no. Okay.
Sarah Watson, 42, everywhere but Twitter. And we've been doing this panel so long, I used to say, 42 is not my age, not even close. And now I'm so far beyond it.
At Anselm Asylum, A-N-S-L-E-M-A-S-Y-L-U-M, everywhere but, you know, fucking fascist.
Bergopolis or just Amy Berg at Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, all of them. And I also wrote recently an essay for Uncanny Magazine about writing for TV. So that should be out in the next issue if you want to learn more.
At Jeff Yorks or at Mr. Jeff Yorks on Instagram.
I'm at Jose Molina TV on most of the things except for Twitter.
And I'm a bunch of the Mark A. Altman, and you can listen to our podcast where we talk about writing a lot on Inglourious Treksports every Thursday and the 4:30 movie on Fridays, because you got to have a podcast, and we have some great ones. I want to thank everyone so much. Hopefully we'll see you again in San Diego. A big happy birthday to Sarah Watson. And thank you, Mark, Derek, Sarah, Slim, Amy, Jeff.
And thank you, Mark Altman, for stepping in and moderating.
Jose.
Give a hand.
Woo! Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, we told you you'd be depressed, and we didn't lie.
Yeah.
It's a depressing state of affairs out there in Hollywood land.
You want to be a writer? Forget it.
So it is written.
Doors closed.
So shall it be done, like Hollywood.
I hope you found it interesting. I know I did. Listening to all these brilliant writers share their stories.
Even I found it interesting.
Yeah, and Darren hates writers, so that was for Darren to find it interesting.
That's right.
But the industry is changing every day, and it's important to understand, because what may have been the case 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, is not the case anymore. Wouldn't you say, Steve, and the business is changing dramatically?
Dramatically and rapidly. You know, it'd be interesting to see what happens as some of these streamers figure out their next business model.
Well, I like to be optimistic about the future. And I've got a couple of reasons for saying that. I think, that number one, you know, we need to, it's not that IATSE has been on strike, but there's been a sort of a shadow slowdown as the studios have been negotiating those contracts. So things haven't really been going into production. Number two, you know, everything that I've been hearing and seeing seems to point to a resurgence in the feature space, which I think is really good for writers, especially in that when I say low, I don't mean like $500,000. I mean like $20 million to like $60 million budget range. I think we'll see a bunch more of those. And I think now that the studios have figured out and everybody has figured out that it's better business to do larger orders of things on the network model, I think we'll see a lot more of those. And I think because of that, a lot of conditions will improve. Right now, it sucks. I like to, you know, look, I'm a Star Trek fan. I like to believe that there are possibilities.
Everything's in transition mode, and the whole industry is cyclical, and certain aspects of it don't sync up often. So it's just one of those things that hopefully everyone will have the ability to last through the low points just as they enjoy the high points.
Yep. Well, it doesn't help. There's so much in play right now with Paramount and potentially Warner Brothers, and that, you know, so there's a lot of people are, you know, they're not putting a lot into production. You know, there's a lot of talk and deals and press announcements, but not a lot that's actually getting made. But at some point, the cupboards will be bare, and these companies are going to need to put out new shows and new movies.
Just get your sizzle reels going for your pitches.
Yeah, that's right. As you learned during the panel, which was so fascinating, the new normal and how things get done in Hollywood. It's a really interesting panel. I hope you agree. And that's one of the joys of being a Deck 78 subscriber. You get access to these great episodes early that nobody else does. So keep your subscription to Deck 78. You can do it on Apple Podcasts through the 4:30 movie or on Spotify through Treksports Plus.com. to keep getting these great Deck 78 episodes every other week. And of course, join us on our new Discord channel where we'll be announcing some upcoming screenings and our live appearances in the future. You may want to come check us out wherever the Deck 78 Dexperts beam in. So on behalf of Stephen Melching, Ashley Adriano, Darren, and myself, Mark A. Albin, fire the rockets.
Deck 78 is an exclusive podcast from Trexperts Plus.